Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Today I'm going to be mostly talking about one huge effort going on in the lab, which is basically trying to capture things that happen in late onset neurodegenerative disorders, mainly focusing on the phenotypes that exist in human brain and trying to see what we can do to alter the phenotypes that are manifested in symptomatic patient brains. So today I will mostly going to be talking about this process called direct reprogramming. And before I get into details of that, I'll start with the kind of general, kind of one of the main focuses of the lab, which is trying to understand what it means to be aged. Here in the diagram, you see that the humans are one of the species that, you know, they live longer than others. And this is very nice, but at the same time, there's one caveat that comes with the fact that we live longer, which is the fact that usually with the aging, that is the primary risk factor that increases the vulnerability to develop neurodegenerative disorders. So what we are trying to do is, as we age, why we become more vulnerable or susceptible to have this late onset or adult onset disorders. And at the same time, the question becomes a bit more complicated because there are different neuronal subtypes that are differentially affected in neurodegenerative disorders. So for example, one of the focuses that I will talk about today will be Huntington's disease. So in Huntington's disease, it is the striatum structure that's mostly affected by the disease. And of course, in Alzheimer's, it's cortical neurons and hippocampal neurons. So what we are trying to do in the lab is how do we model late onset disorders using patient-derived neurons, using human neurons. And while we try to do that, we try to address mainly two key questions. What are the methods that we can use to specifically and also efficiently generate disease-relevant subtypes of human neurons? And not just any neurons, but neurons that mimic the age of elderly individuals. And how do we use this system to study aging as one of the contributing factors for the onset of neurodegeneration? So I'll get into one major experimental platform that we use in the lab, and it's called direct reprogramming. And I'm stealing one nice slide that Jerome and Fred wrote before from the review. That is a direct neural reprogram basically means it's a gain of function studies. So we basically topically introduce some genetic factors into unrelated cell type and have a way of turning that unrelated cell type directly into neurons. So mainly in the field, a lot of starting cell population is fibroblast. So have a way of generating neurons by taking someone's fibroblast and without going through a stem cell stage, and what we can do to use these cells to study neurodegeneration. One thing I noted in the review was Jerome and Fred kindly included miR9 and miR124 because these are two genes that we focus in the lab. So what we do is we basically take two microRNAs, miR9, miR124. It's actually three microRNAs. So miR9 precursor generates two stable mature microRNAs. These are called miR9, and the other one is called miR9 star, and then miR124. So from now, I'll just call them miR9, miR124. So when we ectopically introduce these microRNAs in human fibroblasts, what happens is that there's a direct cell fate transition from fibroblasts to neurons. And the reason why these microRNAs work well kind of goes back. When I was a postdoc in Jerry's lab, what I found was that microRNAs, what they typically do is they try to repress the expression of their target genes. But meanwhile, what they try to do during neural development is that they come up so miR-9, 124, they come up at the onset of neurogenesis. And what they try to do is they try to instruct chromatin modifiers that are multi-subunits, that have multi-subunits, and they try to instruct the chromatin modifiers to have this kind of more neuronal function. So one example is that is exemplified here in this cartoon where you have a cross-section of developing mouse embryo. You're looking at from the top to bottom, and all these green cells, these are neuroprogenitors. And when these neuroprogenitors differentiate out into neurons, then what happens is these subunits of this chromatin remodeling complex called BAF complex, so they switch their subunits. That's how they acquire their function related to different cell types. So in progenitors, there's this high expression of this subunit called BAF53A. And when cells turn into neurons, when they differentiate into neurons, that BAF53A goes away. It gets replaced by BAF53B. And what I found was that it's actually microRNAs that control the process. So these microRNAs, they directly target BAF53A. By the virtue of repressing what's not desired to be expressed in neurons, that allows the incorporation of subunits that are neuron specific, and those include BAF45B, 45C, and BAF53B. And the complexes, they need to have these subunits that are designed to carry out the function of BAF complexes in neurons. And what I found was that microRNAs do that. So microRNAs, miR-9124, they induce the switching of this complex, but at the same time, what we also know is that they do a lot of things. So I apologize, this is a bit of a busy slide, but there are a couple of things I'd like to highlight on this slide. The first one is all these genes that are labeled in red color, they're all different genes doing different things. They all share one thing in common, which is the fact that they are expressed basically everywhere, but selectively absent in neurons. The types of genes that are targeted by these microRNAs are oftentimes involved in repressing the function of so-called anti-neurogenic genes. So what I mean by that is there's one famous example, REST, CoREST, and SCP1. These are complexes, and their main goal is try to repress the expression of neuronal genes in non-neural cell types. So these microRNAs go in and they try to shut that pathway down. At the same time, miR-124, they also shut down the expression of other genes that have that control alternate splicing of genes, trying to promote neuronal genes, but properly spliced. And at the same time, miR-124 is actually pretty smart. So what we found was that miR-124 can target genes, also neuronal genes, when they're expressed. And in conjunction with another RNA binding protein, E11L3, what they also do is they switch over their functional modality as an activator or stabilizer of their neuronal target genes. So they do a lot of things. But one thing that we have to keep in mind is that when these microRNAs go in into non-neuronal cells, they have the capacity to recognize the non-neuronal fate, and they try to shut it down. And by the virtue of that, there's a relief of anti-neurogenic gene function. As a result of that, we start getting neuronal program. So morphologically, the process looks like this. So we include microRNAs in human fibroblast, and we overexpress miR-9124. We made artificial cluster of miR-9, miR-124 together. So we basically drive the whole thing under one promoter. Then we topically express these microRNAs in human fibroblasts, and this is typically what human fibroblasts look like, and they turn into these cells. So these human fibroblasts, they now start adopting the morphological features of neurons. They are post-mitotic, so immediately they come out of cell cycle, and they basically morph into a different fate, and they start expressing the proteins that are expected to be expressed in neurons. Pan-neuronal markers. So these are top three, and these are examples of MAT2. In terms of the temporal progression, if you start from this starting cell population. These are human adult fibroblasts. And then if you monitor them over time, what happens is that you can see cells basically morph into, they kind of cell size shrinks and they sort of morph into D cells in a post-mitotic context. So what D cells represent is essentially a switching of the chromatin landscape. And it's largely due to the fact that these microRNAs target a lot of components of chromatin modifiers. So in terms of reading that, ATAC-seq, we use ATAC-seq as a major genomic tools in the lab. So what you're looking at here is all these loci, they used to be closed in fibroblasts, and then over time, in response to microRNAs they put in, they open up. And at the same time, you see all these regions that used to be open in fibroblasts, and they also close down over time. And it's a controlled process, because if you look at genes that are either opening up, closing down, they're very specific. So if you look at genes that open up, or the chromatin locations that open up, and look at nearby genes, they all have to do with like neuronal projections and functions and neural differentiation. It's the same thing from like day 10, it becomes more in day 20 into reprogramming. And meanwhile, all these regions, they used to be open and closed down, they actually co-align with other histone markers. In this case, we're taking examples from K27 acetylation, which marks the enhancers of fibroblast. So they gain the information from microRNAs, then they start shutting down enhancers required to keep fibroblasts as fibroblasts. So if you look at this process at a single cell resolution over time, what we do know is that from starting cell population, then we sort of try to look at into day 20 of reprogramming, and we try to look at what are the changes that occur at a transcriptome level. So what we noticed was that starting cells, which is cluster 1, and that's the end point around this time, but they are distinctly clustered into different neuronal cell population, reprogramming cell population. What this represents is the fact that when we go from fibroblast to this cluster 2, which is a sort of intermediate stage, what happens is they're very distinct because they lose the identity of fibroblast. And there are a couple of different examples of fibroblast enriched genes. And only after that, we start seeing activation of neuronal genes. And these are a couple of examples. The reason why microRNAs are so potent in terms of inducing this event is because if you look at all genes, they're highly enriched. So all these red colors are different dots, are different genes highly expressed in fibroblast. And then you throw in microRNAs and basically all this network, all this fibroblast network goes away. And it's largely because in this non-neuronal gene network that exists in fibroblast, what happens is there is a sort of embedded with the targets, direct targets of microRNAs. So they target all these important genes, and they are expected to be highly expressed in fibroblasts to keep them as fibroblasts, and these microRNAs basically erase that state. In terms of our understanding of neuronal reprogramming, it's a very deterministic process. It's not some stochastic event. And it's mainly based on the fact that we know exactly what are the targets of these microRNAs when they're introduced into a fibroblast. And these are a couple of examples that are required to keep them as fibroblasts. They need to go away. They're directly targeted by microRNAs. And as a result of that, all these chromatin loci important to keep them as fibroblasts, they close down. And after that, the neuronal genes kick in. And this is also a deterministic process. So one example of that is the activation of this small nuclear RNA called RN7SK. And that one needs to go up, because if we block this process, then basically cells look like they're stuck in the middle of the neuronal conversion. What's also important about this state when the neuronal program is being activated is that's the time point that we can also combine with different transcription factors expressed in different parts of the brain, and that really allows us to push the neuronal conversion into very distinct neuronal subtypes. So in this example, if we combine microRNA-induced neuronal state with these transcription factors, ISL1 and LHX3, what we do is then we push the conversion into motor neurons, because LHX3, ISL1, these are highly expressed motor neurons. So when the synergism kicks in between microRNAs and transcription factors, the system becomes quite robust. So they're also physiologically active. They also start expressing the markers of motor neurons. And beside these electrophysiological properties and like neuronal markers, what we also pay close attention is to analyze genes that are long. So we call this long gene expression. And we do this because we need a way of not just looking at a couple of neuronal genes, but as a whole transcriptomic feature that we can use as an indication of neuronal identity. So what I mean by a long gene expression is we have a collection of genes that are pretty long. It's like bigger than about 150 or 200 kb from start to stop. And then if you measure the expression of these genes that tend to be long, only in neurons there's accumulation of long gene expression. And this is also reflected by the cells that are undergoing neuronal reprogramming around this time point, which is the end point of neuronal reprogramming, and that's the time point we start seeing the expression of long genes, right? Along with the other neuronal markers. So using this method, what we do is then we introduce microRNAs, and then we combine that with a different set of transcription factors. And the idea is we push the neuronal conversion into distinct neuronal subtypes. And today I'm going to be mostly focused on striatal medium spine neurons, because we try to model Huntington's disease. And towards the end of my talk, I also go into some cortical neurons that we generate as a way to model Alzheimer's disease. So before we start getting into the modeling aspect, there's one extremely important aspect of this directly reprogrammed neurons. And that has to do with the age of directly reprogrammed neurons. And it's important to keep in mind that, as I mentioned in the beginning of my presentation, the goal is to not necessarily age cells in culture over time, but more about having the ability to take a snapshot, age-associated snapshot, at that chronological age of the patients. So we need to have pretty thorough understanding of what's happening at the age of reprogrammed neurons. So one thing that we looked at is this analysis called epigenetic clock analysis. This was discovered by Steve Horvath back in UCLA. It's a collection of DNA methylation patterns, about 350 loci in our genome, whose methylation patterns are collectively associated with the chronological ages. So what we did was to take fibroblast samples from baby all the way to 80-year-old person. Then we measured the clock, and then we turned them into neurons using microRNAs, and then we measured the epigenetic clock before and after conversion. And basically our conclusion was that the epigenetic methylation or epigenetic age information carries over into neurons. And this finding aligns well with what Jerome and Fred found before, that basically all the transcriptome, microRNAs, cellular properties that exist in skin fibroblasts as a reflection of the age of the donor, that information carries over. And then also another thing that I like to mention is that beside epigenetic clock, transcriptome, it's also the alternative splicing that are age-associated, that information also carries over into neurons. So in this example, I'm showing you examples of reprogrammed neurons using microRNAs and MIT1L. And here we are using ISX9. It's a small molecule, but it's kind of nice because when we apply small molecule ISX9, it activates endogenous neuroD-family transcription factors. So by doing that, we can sort of push the neuronal conversion into cortical neurons. So when we do that, then we see the reprogrammed neurons. And one thing that I like to highlight is the expression of this tau protein, which is neuronal neuronal gene. So when we look at transcript of tau, something interesting that we can detect. So what we know is that tau undergoes alternate splicing. So in general, tau can express six different isoforms of tau. And these are largely divided into two different isoforms. One is called 3R, these ones, and the other one is called 4R. And that means 3R ones have three repeat domains, whereas 4R contains four repeat domains. The interesting thing is that during embryogenesis, when neurons are born, the embryo neurons typically express only one isoform of six. It's this one, 0 and 3R. But in adult brain, there are all six different isoforms. And when we go from adult fibroblasts into neurons directly, that's the method that allows us to look at all six different isoforms of tau. And this is important because when we study tau dysregulation, usually, for example, in Alzheimer's context, they have all six different isoforms, like 3R, 4R, making up the tau tangles. So beside tau, and also if we look at other genes, so it is a bit complex, but one message I like to carry out here is that if you look at alternate splicing, age-associated alternate splicing for other genes, and you're looking at the pattern that you see from fetal brain versus adult brain, and here we are looking at the pattern that we see from embryonic stem cell differentiated neurons versus direct reprogrammed neurons, what you see is that that pattern, the different alternate splicing pattern, basically carries over when cells start activating these neuronal genes. And here's another example, looks similar, and here in adult context, that basically carries over into reprogrammed neurons. So age-associated isoform control in reprogrammed neurons is actually age-associated that we can capture. So with that notion, let me get into the disease modeling effort going on in the lab. So one of the focuses of the lab is to be able to model Huntington's disease, but specifically adult onset Huntington's disease. So Huntington's disease is an inherited disorder and is caused by mutation, the expansion mutation, CAG, within this gene called Huntington. And that when that expansion number exceeds 36, mostly in the range of 40 and beyond, the disease is there. Most of times it's an adult onset disorder. Usually the symptomatic stage starts when patients reach the middle age, around 40 and 50, and is characterized by massive cell death of striatal medium spiny neurons. There are some population of cortical neurons that also degenerate, but in the lab, our goal is to model neurodegeneration of medium spiny neurons. So what we do is then we take microRNAs, and then we combine that with the transcription factors. We collectively call them CDM factors, but these are composed of CTIP2, DLX12, and MIT1L. And these are especially CTIP2 and DLX12, they're kind of highly expressed, more specifically expressed in the striatum area. And what we do is then we combine these factors into fibroblasts that we collect from patients who are symptomatic. And usually they have repeat numbers in the range of 40. And then we take fibroblasts and then we turn them into neurons by direct conversion, but specifically towards medium spiny neurons. So when we do that, this is typically what the tissue culture looks like when we turn patient fibroblasts into neurons. So these are used to be fibroblasts from patients, but now turned into medium spiny neurons, MSN. So we just call them HDMSNs. But they provide one important aspect of understanding the disease, which is the fact that when we turn cells into neurons by direct conversion, and we see phenotypes that are typically seen in patient brains. So those examples include the formation of mutant Huntington aggregation, we call it inclusion bodies, that are typically seen in patient neurons. And also, they show DNA damage more than controls. And most importantly, over time, when they acquire the neuronal identity or medium spiny neuron identity in culture, then they start degenerating over time. And this is seen in this plot where the amount of neurodegeneration around this time is highly significantly higher for patient-derived neurons. So when we found these phenotypes in these patient-derived neurons, we were really excited because, for example, like inclusion bodies and neurodegeneration that have been quite important to capture in patient-derived neurons. So since we see the phenotypes, one thing that we wanted to see was any of these phenotypes that we can detect has anything to do with aging. So to answer that, one experiment that we did was we tried to erase the age from starting patient fibroblast. So we can do so by inducing induced pluripotent stem cells. And after that, we can also redrive fibroblasts out of it. So they become sort of younger or embryonic version of adult fibroblast. So we have these two populations, embryonic, younger version, and adult version. Then we turn them into neurons using the same reprogramming methods. So when we do that from embryonic version of this fibroblast, then we can generate the patient-specific neurons, and then we can also go from adult fibroblast directly neurons. Then we have these two populations, young and old. And if we do that, then if we erase the age information, basically the phenotype goes away that we used to see. This is one example where we looked at the formation of inclusion bodies. So the maintenance of age, it's one of the critical aspects of kind of enforcing the disease associated the phenotypes that are seen in patient-derived neurons. So to take this idea further, what Young-Mi Oh and Sungwon Lee, who are now running their own labs, what they tried to see was if we collect fibroblast samples from younger patients before they start showing any symptoms, but they still have mutation, and compare them to patient-derived neurons that we derive from patients who are symptomatic and older, and compare them to controls where they don't have mutations, but young population and also old population, and generate four different neuronal population. One is control young, control old, and pre-symptomatic, so younger, and also older patient-derived neurons. So one important thing is that if we look at neuronal reprogramming, the output as neurons, this is one example of the long gene expression analysis. So regardless young or old fibroblast or pre-symptomatic, post-symptomatic, the conversion is consistent. But what was striking was that if you measure neurodegeneration, that was specific for post-symptomatic neurons or neurons that we generate from post-symptomatic neurons. And this is one example of readout of cytotoxic screening, which basically marks the cells that are undergoing neuronal death. And the same thing applies for neuritis degeneration. So if you look at this population, young, old control, pre-symptomatic, young patient, old patient, it's only in old patient neurons that we start seeing the evidence of neurite degeneration. So by doing so, even taking patient-derived neurons, but depending on where patients were before or after the onset of clinical symptoms, we can sort of model the progression of the disease by using this method. We found many interesting pathways, but let me just highlight one component. If you look at chromatin accessibility between pre-symptomatic, post-symptomatic stages, we detect all these regions that share one thing in common, that close down with aging in patient context. So they include binding sites for this important transcription factor called STAT3. So now STAT3 binding regions that are important for activating components of autophagosome. These are a couple of examples, ATG5 and 7. With the aging in patient neurons, they have decreased propensity to be able to activate components of autophagism. And this is largely due to the increased expression, increased age-associated expression of miR-29b3p, which is microRNA. So it's interesting that if you look at this microRNA expression in just with aging in different patient population, also in the brain, that microRNA goes up a bit with aging. But in the context of HTT mutation, miR-29b3p, that microRNA expression goes up drastically. And as a result of that, what happens is because miR-29b3p directly targets 3' UTR of STAT3. So in disease context, STAT3, the repression becomes more pronounced. And this has largely to do with the increased expression of miR-29b3p. Right? So it's one kind of snapshot of you know how we can use the aging in patient context and trying to figure out what may be the underlying mechanism that contributes to the onset of neurodegeneration. And this finding is a reduced autophagy that is age-associated. So by taking this analogy, what we also did was to take fibroblast samples from the same person. So we have fibroblast samples from collected once during middle age and collected again roughly about 20 years later. So there are collections of those fibroblast samples. So they become longitudinal collections of fibroblast samples separate by about 20 years of age. So if we do that, then we can generate neurons that represent same isogenic background from same person but multiple people. Then we try to see what are the differences that we can detect in this longitudinal modeling context. So we just published this study, but one important pathway that we found was the upregulation of this protein called RCAN1. So RCAN1 expression goes up with aging in the striatum, and it's just something we saw from patients when young postmortem samples in the range of 20 and 30 compared to later postmortem samples. What we see is the increased expression of RCAN1 in patient in human striatum samples. And this is also reflected when we look at RCAN1 in young versus old samples from multiple people. So this is something that's consistent. And what's also important is that if you look at what RCAN1 does, the reason why we really got into this RCAN1 pathway is initially, we basically screened about 300 genes, and these 300 genes are some the collection of genes are that are known as Huntington's disease modifying genes. So we're taking the hits, GWAS hits from this study, GEM-HD study, genetic modifier Huntington study. Then we try to see what genes are the ones that promote kind of neuronal or decline of neuronal health in the disease context. And we identify three genes out of it, and one of them happens to be RCAN1. So RCAN1, RTCA, and the UB2B4. So while doing like two things separately, we somehow stumbled onto like RCAN1 that's age-associated at the same time is one of the modifiers that can modify Huntington's disease phenotypes. And also, RCAN1 knockdown also promotes survival. At the same time, it can also help clear the aggregation of Huntington. So by going through all these different genetic modifier genes, RCAN1 was the only one that also modifies the protein clearance phenotype. So what is RCAN1? So RCAN1 is known as negative regulator of calcineurin. Calcineurin itself is a very important gene. It's a calcium-activated phosphatase. And what they tend to do is they tend to remove phosphorylation from transcription factors, and then they promote nuclear localization of transcription factors. What was really interesting was the fact that if you knock down RCAN1, we reduce the amount of inclusion bodies, but at the same time, we try to see whether there's direct relationship between RCAN1 and calcineurin. And if that's the case, it reprogrammed neurons. And what we found was that if we knock down RKN1, cells become protected. If we knock down calcineurin itself, then the cell death becomes actually worse. So it's really through this pathway, kind of we infer by kind of epistatic testing between RKN1 and calcineurin. What's cool about this finding is that now we have different conditions of cell survival. So in Huntington's disease, these cells die, but if we knock down RKN1, the cells now tend to be healthier. If we knock down calcineurin, and then cells appear to be more vulnerable. So what we can do is then, in response to different conditions of neuronal health, we can try to look for chromatin regions that open up more when cells are being rescued, and we can also try to look at what are the exact ones that actually close down more when cells are undergoing more neurodegeneration. So if we do that, then we identify these chromatin regions by ATAC-seq, and if we look at, try to look at what genes are, what transcription factors could potentially bind to these regions, one thing that really popped up was this transcription factor called TFAB. And as you know, the TFAB is commonly known as the master regulator of autophagy. So what it does is by the virtue of controlling the expression of RKN1, we can actually control the phosphorylation state of TFAB. So as shown in this example, if we monitor the expression of TFAB in control, and then we knock down RKN1, we promote nuclear localization of TFAB. And this is also mimicked by the phosphomutant form of TFAB. And this is a process, the RKN1 calcineurin sort of antagonizing them is also a process that we can control by chemicals. So in this example, I'm showing you one chemical called G2 compound. So G2 is an analog of glibenclamide. And this is something that was developed by Dr. Perlmutter and his group at WashU. And what we found was that if you look at kind of binding assay between RKN1 and calcineurin, by adding G2, we can actually reduce the interaction in comparison to other autophagy-inducing chemicals. So by looking at this different age state and also different age-associated mechanism, what we can try to do is we can try to come up with a ways of making this post-symptomatic older state more towards this pre-symptomatic older state. And so far we found three different mechanisms that we can tap in. One is by using G2 compound that mimics the reduced function of RKN1. And also we can do this by reducing the expression of age-associated upregulation mirror 29B3P. Knowing this, like how aging plays a role in this kind of disease modeling angle, our ultimate goal was also try to see whether we can model kind of neurodegeneration, but not solely based on mutations. So one most famous example of that will be late onset Alzheimer's. So what we have been trying to do is trying to see whether we can create a system by converting someone's skin cells into neurons, but someone who has been diagnosed as late onset Alzheimer's. And three major phenotypes that we look for. One is amyloid beta plaques, extracellular deposition of plaques, and tau tangles, intracellular tau tangles, and also the actual neurodegeneration. And just to highlight more, the population of patients that we're going for is sporadic late onset Alzheimer's. So to do this, what we have done is we tweaked the system a bit. So instead of doing the neural reprogramming in two-dimensional context, now what we do is then we try to do this direct reprogramming, but in three-dimensional context. And we have two different approaches for it. One is kind of simple. We when we generate neurons, we express these microRNAs, and in this case, more cortical lineage by adding NeuroD family transcription factors, especially NeuroD2 and Mi1L. So we push them towards cortical neurons, but through sort of in the middle of the reprogramming, we replate them into thin layer of Matrigel. So they basically, cells still reprogram in three-dimensional context. And as you can see by long gene expression over time, around day 30, they really reach the enhancement of long gene expression. Typically, this is what the cells look like. This is one example where we have the cells in 96 well context. Then you can see that cells are very much enriched with the reprogrammed neurons in thin gel layer. And another one that we use is more high cell density. It's a more high cell density based cell aggregates. And what I mean by that is when we replace cells after they start expressing new reprogramming reagents, then we basically form them into this type of spherical formats of like cells that are reprogramming, but in sort of spheroids. So what we do is we let them assemble, let them stick to each other in media, and we sort of lay out a blanket of Matrigel, and from the bottom of the well, then we feed the whole thing from the bottom up. So when we do it around day 30, actually a little earlier than that, this is the typical format that we see from spheroids, where they form the core and they start sending out neurites outward. And the same thing holds true in terms of neural identity. We see high expression of long genes. So by doing so, what we have noticed so far is quite interesting. So if we generate neurons from late onset Alzheimer's patients in comparison to age-matched control samples, we actually start seeing aggregation of A-beta outside the cell, and this is quite robust. And this is the phenotype that we can detect in thin gel layer context. And if you have them, this becomes more obvious. If you have them as a spheroid, and then look at the basically fix it and you clear it and you know, you stain for A-beta, then you see much more accumulation of the A-beta signal when the spheroid comes from late onset Alzheimer's. If you can cut them up, so when they form these spheroids, we can cut them up, and they are really extracellular A-beta deposition. This phenotype that we see A-beta is not a random phenotype, because if we block the APP processing during the process of reprogramming, basically the A-beta phenotype kind of goes away. So we can do this by treating cells with a gamma secretase the beta secretase or gamma secretase inhibitors. But what's interesting is that once they start forming aggregation, if we treat these spheroids with these compounds, actually the aggregation actually doesn't go away. So it kind of matters when we treat the spheroids with the compounds. Another phenotype that we saw was the actual hyperphosphorylation of tau. And you know, the phosphorylation can happen with a tau, but what we really went for is any indication of hyperphosphorylated tau that are aggregating. So we checked the 3R4R, mainly because the tau tangles are composed of both 3R and 4R. So they express 3R4R tau, and we see more phosphorylation of tau. And what we also can mark is that all the, it's kind of hard to see, but we tend to see all these neurites kind of bulging up over time. And then when they bulge up, we can actually co-mark them with a ubiquitin. And this is a co-localization between ubiquitin and tau. This is something seen in the patient brains too. We also collaborate with Mark Diamond because he has the tau FRET reporters. So you can express these FRET reporters. One is Ruby and the other one is Clover. If there's a presence of seed competent tau in a cell, what happens is these two reporters are brought together and there's energy transfer that we can measure as a FRET signal. So what we found was that in late onset Alzheimer's, if you look at all these regions that are bulging up, these are the locations where we can actually see the FRET signal. So we feel confident that these late onset neurons they regenerate have seed competent tau. In terms of neurodegeneration, if we culture healthy spheroid right next to late onset spheroid and we carry out conversion over time, around day 30 into reprogramming, what we tend to see is also there's a reduction of the spheroid sizes compared to control. So there's we did this method because we wanted to see whether there's any cell intrinsic properties that drive the onset of neurodegeneration. Now we are trying to understand this mechanism, but what we saw was that if we do this, somehow these late onset patient neurons undergo much more neuronal death compared to controls. One last phenotype that I'd like to discuss is this phenotype when we generate neurospheres, and as I mentioned before, they start sending out processes, but in late onset context, they send out processes initially, but over time they retract. And it's I think it's largely because of the neurodegeneration going on in the core of the spheres. So these are phenotypes that we know, that we've been working on, and trying to see, you know, what aspect of neurodegeneration that we can model. And the one interesting conclusion for us was that just by inducing neuronal state from late onset Alzheimer's patients, that we can actually induce some of the neuronal features, neuronal pathological features. And now this became sort of framework, then we can start start including other neuronal cell types, mostly astrocytes, including microglia, and try to see how these different cell types can affect this age associated and also Alzheimer's disease associated phenotypes. So with that, let me conclude with a brief summary. So microRNAs, miR-9 and miR-124, we use them because they're pretty potent, and actually they're quite smart once neuronal genes kick in. And then we use them as reprogramming factors that that work through inducing chromatin state landscape changes. And then cells are neuronally converted, and that we can use them to study different disorders. Core expression of subtype-defining transcription factors on top of miR-9124. When they synergize, the system becomes quite robust in terms of inducing specific neuronal subtypes. And we can use these cells to study age-associated neurodegeneration. If there's any one message that I'd like to highlight in my talk, is the importance of age. This is actually very important to capture something that is age-associated. And also, once we see the phenotype, then we can try to identify gene networks or mechanisms that may underlie neurodegeneration. So far, our focus has been mostly on autophagy. So with that, let me thank my lab members, past and previous, and current. A lot of work that I discussed today with Alzheimer's was carried out by Zhao. And then the Huntington's stuff, Huntington's modeling work was mainly done by, Songwon and Youngmi. And I'd like to thank my collaborators within WashU and also outside WashU and my funding sources. Thank you.
I had one question, like your sphere model, where you're combining this green healthy sphere with the red Alzheimer's sphere. Did you observe any negative influence of the AD sphere on the healthy sphere? I mean, you showed that the AD sphere was smaller and degenerating, but comparing to like a red sphere that would be also healthy, do you see a crosstalk between those spheres?
So initially we thought that it should, so some of the disease pathology could transfer over to the control neurons. In terms of the amount of A beta that we can detect, it's kind of hard for that to sort of carry over into wild type, the control side. But we do see some reduction of this spheroid size compared to before. So it's about, we're talking like 10% reduction versus like 40% reduction. Yeah.
And have you looked at amyloid pathology? You also mentioned tau that it's like seed competent tau. So eventually you would expect some pathology like moving over.
Yeah, moving over into reprogrammed neurons, right? So we actually trying to answer that more in vivo context. So a lot of work what we do with the reprogrammed neurons is still in culture, but we also have some effort where we actually take these late onset neurons into the mouse brain and see whether we can actually induce some, do some cellular induction of Alzheimer's. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a beautiful talk.
Thank you.
I have a question about relating to the Huntington model you proposed. Mm-hmm. And in the direct conversion, you preserve the mutant Huntington aggregate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And other than the soma, do you see the presence of mutant Huntington aggregate in the processes?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I didn't have time to discuss the location of those. So the number one region that we see the inclusion bodies is actually around the nucleus. So we see in the soma more, but we do see some in the neurites too. But in terms of scoring, we score whether it's in the neurites or in the around in soma, around the nucleus. But if we break them down into two, we see three different locations. So some in the neurites, more in around the nucleus, and some in the nucleus. Yeah, thanks.
Hi, Andrew. Hi. Thank you for your talk. My question is, if you see iPSC-derived neurons in 3D, will you expect to see any A-beta accumulation?
From the same... So that have been tried before. So we don't do brain organoid. I think that was more done with kind of early onset familial cases. So I don't know.
Thank you.
Maybe if you culture them for a long time. But I know that because we don't have any mutations within APP or presenilin, it's kind of hard to see a lot of it, yeah. But I don't know the answer. Yeah.
I have a question about your Huntington model again, and I'm very intrigued by the finding that you had that the neurons from pre-symptomatic patients were essentially similar to or the same as controls. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that matches with what we think is happening in the patients. And I think most people in the field feel that there's still neuronal pathology and neuronal loss happening before these patients are symptomatic.
Yeah.
And some of the characterization you did of the, I think, ARCAN was done, you're showing compared between 30-year-olds and 70-year-olds, but these patients, by the time they're 30, are very symptomatic. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you, you're suggesting a very different way of looking at the neurodegeneration, that almost that these neurons are almost normal in some sense, until they reach a certain age, and then some switch, maybe not instantaneously, kicks in, and neurodegeneration happens. Whereas I think many people in the field feel like there's a neurodegeneration that's happening all the time, and it starts at an early age, but they don't become symptomatic until you get a certain threshold of neuronal loss, then it becomes apparently clinically apparent. But the disease process on the cellular scale is happening the entire time.
So, it's a great question. Yeah, great. So I think the studies that we've done so far, we don't have that time resolution where we detect, because the time gap, the age gap that we have as pre-symptomatic versus symptomatic patient samples, they're actually quite apart. A lot of pre-symptomatic samples are in their teens and early 20s. So I think to be able to tackle on the actual progression, we need more time resolution to have more firm conclusion. So because the phenotypes, we just go by what phenotypes they give us. The one caveat is that the time span between symptomatic versus post-symptomatic, it's actually quite large. So we need to get more, like pre-symptomatic samples, let's say like 2 years before the onset, 5 years.
But what would be your prediction? What would be your prediction? Do you think that these cells are pathological and it's a continuum, or do you feel that there could be some kind of, switch is a strong word, but a discrete change that happens with aging in these neurons that explains the timing of onset, which is what you're sort of suggesting.
Yeah, I think like in terms of speculation, because these are all like age-associated pathways we look at. So we have to model it first so that we can see what kind of differences we can detect. My speculation is like something as drastic as neurodegeneration may be similar, but in terms of other disease pathologies, you know, aggregation or you know, DNA damage and all that, there may be some differences, but we just don't know until.
I have one more question from the room that I'm reading out to you. Sure. Is there any relation between microRNAs and Parkinson's disease? And can you model that?
Yeah, so Parkinson's, we had some, still like one of my postdocs is trying to develop models of Parkinson's disease. What we know is that if you look at chromatin landscape, like the regions that open up, we know that the TH region opens up. So they're being poised to activate a TH, but that TH loci, like trying to come up with the right transcription factor cocktails to activate that's been tough. So we're still working on it. So our effort has been sort of up to the point that we're trying to generate dopaminergic neurons.
So if you have more questions, I'm going to just like continue with one or two from the chat. Sure. So one, Mara Burns is asking, are you able to directly convert into other cell types such as astrocytes or microglia?
I'd love to. So the astrocyte, our next goal is to do something with astrocytes because I'm quite interested in APOE. We tried a couple of published protocols. We couldn't actually quite do it, so we need to optimize more, but we haven't been able to do it. With the microRNAs, it's hard to do it because cells come out of cell cycle a little too fast, so we need to pinpoint a condition where we can actually just erase the fate and start testing different factors to push them towards astrocytes, but we are not there yet.
Yeah, I wish we had a good protocol. One more question that I'm excited about from an anonymous attendee. The aging phenotype is carried over from fibroblasts to induced neurons and is responsible for the susceptibility of those neurons. But that aging phenotype is from fibroblasts and not aging phenotype of the neurons in people. Any thoughts about that? What's your answer to that? Because I get that question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a deep question. There are some pathways, for example, age-associated microRNAs and those ones that we know we can compare between starting fibroblasts and neurons, and that relationship holds true. So another example would be epigenetic clock. But some phenotypes are a reflection of cells now turning into neurons. And so ARCN1 is actually a good example. So in fibroblasts, if we compare ARCN1 level in fibroblasts, like young and old, we actually don't see that difference. We only see it when we turn them towards neuronal context, and that's when we start seeing the differences. So the differences, kind of depend on how we think about it. Are we really going for the global aging process versus like, you know, brain specific or neuron specific process? So the answer is all of the above. Some critical phenotypes that we've been seeing so far, like miR-29B expression, autophagy reduction, and those phenotypes we see as a reflection of cells turned into neurons, but not in fibroblasts.
Okay, if there are no further questions, thank you again, Andrew, and everyone for attending and the lively discussion. And see you next time.
Thank you for attention.